Hello, and welcome to the Text in Us podcast. I'm your host, George Fricks, and I'm here with my co-host, L. Grover Fricks, to resume our discussions in Exodus chapter 38 and 39.
It's another double down episode. We are rocketing to a finish here in Exodus. So much tabernacle, so little time. So I'm gonna get to it.
Yeah.
Scroll of Shemot, chapter 38 and 39. From acacia tree, he made this slaughtering place of things sent up, 5 amah in length, 5 amah in width, square, 3 amah in height. He made his horns upon 4 corners. From it were his horns. He made it shine with serpentine bronze. He made all the clinking things for the slaughtering place. He made the boiling pots, the shovels, and the sprinkling vessel, and the flesh hook, and the snuffers. He made all of the clinking things of serpentine bronze. He made for the slaughtering place a lattice work, a serpentine bronze net under the edge from below to halfway. He cast 4 rings for 4 boundaries for the lattice work of serpentine bronze, houses for the lone pieces. He made the lone pieces of acacia tree. He made them shine with serpentine bronze. He brought the lone pieces in the rings upon the ribs of the slaughtering place to bear it in them. Hollowing slabs he made it. He made the basin of serpentine bronze and its base of serpentine bronze from the looking glass of the warrior women who arrayed at the opening of the tent of the appointed time. He made the court for the corner of the Negev toward the sea. The hangings of the court were bleached white linen twisted 100 amah. Their pillars were 20. Their pedestals were 20 of serpentine bronze. The hooks of the pillars, their links were silver for the corner of the north. 100 amah, 20 pillars. Their pedestals were 20 serpentine bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their links were silver for the corner of the sea. Hangings 50 in amah, 10 of their pillars in their pedestals. Then hooks of the pillars and their links were silver for the corner of the east from the Dan, 50 amah. Hangings 50 amah for the shoulder, 3 of their pillars and 3 of their pedestals for the second shoulder from this and from this side for the gate of the court. Hangings of 15 amah, their pillars and their pedestals 3. All of the hangings of the court all around were of bleached white linen twisted with many threads. The pedestals for the pillars were serpentine bronze, the hooks of the pillars and their links silver, the shining of their heads was silver, they were linked in silver. All the pillars of the court, the woven hedge of the gate of the court, the work of a weaver, violet and purple and scarlet, bleached white linen woven with many threads, 20 amah in length and height and width, 5 amah alongside the hangings of the court. Their pillars were 4 and their pedestals 4 of serpentine bronze. Their hooks were silver, the shining of their heads and their links were silver. All the pins for the abiding place and for the court around were serpentine bronze. These are the things for the attending of the abiding place of the testimonies which were attended to upon the mouth of Moshe. The service of the Levi'im, entwined ones, in the hand of Ithamar, desire of date palms, son of Aharon, the opulent delegate, and Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, for the staff of Yehuda, made all that Yahweh commanded Moshe. With him was Ahaliav, son of Achisamach, for the staff of Dan, engraver and thinker and weaver of violet and purple and scarlet and in bleached white linen, all the gold that was made in the filling work. And all the filling work of the set apart, the gold waved was 29 rounds, 730 measured shekels in the measure of the set apart, the silver from those attending the appointed time, 100 rounds and 1,705 and 70 shekels in the measure of the set apart. Rent in 2 for each skull. From 0.5 shekel, a shekel of the set apart for all who crossed over to attend from the son of 20 years to over for 600,000 and 3,550. There were 100 rounds of silver for the casting of the pedestals of the set apart and the pedestals of the fracturing partition. 100 pedestals for 100 of the rounds, 1 round for a pedestal, 1,705 and 70. He made hooks for the pillars and made their heads shine and links for them in serpentine bronze. The waving of 70 rounds and 2,400 shekels, he made it in pedestals for the opening of the tent of the appointed time, and the serpentine bronze slaughtering place, and the lattice work of serpentine bronze for it, and all the clinking things for the slaughtering place, the pedestals for the court all around, and pedestals for the gate of the court, and all the pins for the abiding place, and all the pins of the court all around. Chapter 39. From the violet and the purple and the scarlet, they made stitched clothing to minister in the set apart. And they made the clothing of the set apart for Aharon, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He made the apron of gold, violet, and purple, and scarlet threads, and bleached white linen. They stamped bird traps of the gold. They snipped wire to make within it the violet and the purple and the fibers of the scarlet, and within the bleached white linen. A well-thought work. They made shoulders for it, coupled in friendship upon two boundaries. Coupled in friendship, the thoughtfully woven part of his apron over it. It was made the same, gold and violet and purple and scarlet and bleached white linen woven with many threads, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. They made stones of shaham and closed and checkered settings of openings of gold, openings of a signet upon the names of the sons of Yisrael. He placed them upon the shoulders of the apron, stones of remembrance for the sons of Yisrael. As Yahweh commanded Moshe, he made the sparkling ornament, well-thought workmanship like that of the apron of gold and violet and purple and scarlet thread and bleached white linen woven with many threads. It was square and doubled. They made the sparkling ornament, a handbreadth in length and a handbreadth in width, as doubled. They filled in it four rows of stones, row, redstone and Sanskrit stone and morning stone, row the first. The second row, Phoenician stone and sapphire and the smiting stone. The third row, the leshem stone and the flaming stone and the dream stone. The fourth row, the stone of Tarshish and the shaham stone and polished stone. They were enclosed in gold settings in their fillings, the stones upon the names of the sons of Yisrael. Look here, 12 upon their names, openings of the signet, each one upon his own name. They were for the 12 tribes, and they made upon the sparkling ornament twisting necklaces braided of clean gold. And they made two settings of gold and two rings of gold. They gifted two of the rings upon two of the boundaries for the sparkling ornament. They gifted two braids of gold upon the two rings for the boundaries of the sparkling ornament. Two of the boundaries of the two braids, they gave two settings. They gave them upon the shoulders of the apron toward the front of its face. They made two rings of gold. They put them upon the two boundaries of the sparkling ornament upon the lip of it, which is for the crossing over of the house of the apron. They made two rings of gold. They put them upon the two shoulders of the apron from underneath the front of his face alongside its joining seam above the woven waistband of the apron. They bound the sparkling ornament from the rings to the rings of the apron in a violet cord to be above the woven waistband of the apron, that the sparkling ornament will not be displaced from the apron, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. He made the cloak of the apron entwined all of violet, and a mouth of the cloak in his midst as the mouth of a tachra, woven for the mouth all around that it will not be rent in two. They made upon the skirt of the cloak pomegranates of violet and purple and woven scarlet. They made bells of clean gold. They gifted the bells in the midst of the pomegranates upon the skirt of the cloak all around in the midst of the pomegranates. A bell and a pomegranate and a bell and a pomegranate upon the skirt of the cloak all around to minister as Yahweh commanded Moshe. They made tunics checkered with bleached white linen for Aharon and his sons, and a rolled turban of bleached white linen and beautiful hills of bleached white linen and woven linen coverings and a waistband of bleached white linen finely woven with violet and purple and scarlet threads, the work of a weaver, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. They wrote upon it an inscription of the openings of the signet, set apart for Yahweh. They gifted to it a violet wire to gift it upon the rolled turban above it, as Yahweh commanded Moshe. She finished all the service of the abiding place of the tent of the appointed time. The sons of Yisrael made all as Yahweh commanded Moshe. So they made it. They brought the abiding place to Moshe, the tent and his clinking things and his bent hooks and his planks, his reaching beams and his pillars and his pedestals and the covering of the reddened ram skins and the covering of the skins of the tachashim and the fracturing partition of the woven hedge, the chest of the testimonies and his lone pieces and the smeared atonement and the table and all the clinking things and the bread of the faces, the clean place of oil lights, the oil lamps, the lamps arrayed, and all her clinking things, and oil for the light, and the slaughtering place of gold and oil. oil of the anointing and the incense of the spices and the woven hedge of the opening of the tent. The serpentine bronze slaughtering place and the lattice work of serpentine bronze for it, his loan pieces and all his clinking things and the basin with its base and the hangings of the court and her pillars and her pedestals and her woven hedge for the gate of the court and his cord and her pins and all the clinking things for the service of the abiding place of the tent of the appointed time. The braided clothing to minister and the set apart, the clothing of the set apart for Aharon, the opulent delegate, and the clothing of his sons to be opulent delegates, according to all that Yahweh commanded Moshe. So the sons of Yisrael made all the service. Moshe looked at the filling work. Look here, they had done it as Yahweh commanded, like this they had done it. Moshe knelt and blessed them. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Yeah, I'd imagine that we also can share in some of the relief of Moshe here, right? Just imagining him having a one giant like, phew, we also, much smaller amount of time dedicated to this, but still, I experience some of that. Phew, we have made it through a long section.
Yeah. I think that there's probably at least some relief. There's also, I think, coming up following after this, he has to put it all together. Sages say that when this is brought to him, right, it's all brought in pieces to Moshe, and then Moshe has to assemble it himself.
The biggest Lego set of all time.
It is, yeah. And there is an element to this which might come as a surprise. They say that the tabernacle actually assembles itself magically. He's just kind of going through the motions of putting the pieces in different spots. And they say that because there's really no way that he could put this together by himself.
A little Beauty and the Beast, not, yeah, enchanted castle situation.
Exactly. So he's kind of going through the motions of, you know, raising his arms and moving the beams and all that kind of stuff. But it's really magically floating through the air and putting itself together, which I think is pretty lit.
It's certainly fun, and I could use those powers around the house. But
yeah, that'd be great if we could all just assemble our homes that way. I think many families would be blessed.
Yeah, should, you know, forget praying for other gifts of the Spirit. Pray for that one. Okay, this first section right at the top is normal, but around verse 8, I believe, we get to a fun little verse that I love to highlight, I love to talk about. And I'll just read that again. From the looking glass of the warrior women who arrayed at the opening of the tent of the appointed time. That's in reference to making the basin of serpentine bronze and its base of serpentine bronze. That is not the usual translation.
No, it's not. If we look at our three that we're utilizing right now, NRSV and the NJB, are both going to go with a form of the woman who served. And Robert Alter is going to use...
flocked, I think.
Yeah, it's flocked. So the woman who flocked... So they have a little bit of a different
approach
that they're going with that word.
Okay, I'll tell you why that makes sense and why it doesn't make sense. So the flocked translation, I will give 3/4 of a cup of credit.
Okay.
Because the word, one of the pictures behind the word here is lining up. Which makes sense if you think of warriors. It's like amassing an army, which is why I use array there. It has to do with aligning people up. So yeah. I get that. I do have a problem with the service translation because for those of us who were raised in a certain kind of church culture, when we imagine women in service, you know, that means making sure that there's coffee and checking people in and handing out flyers or bulletins and preparing the Kool-Aid and cookies, etc. That's not this word. So this word is the word tzava. And it's the same as one of the titles of God. We have Adonai Tzavaot, which folks will be familiar with if they sing Almighty Fortress is Our God, for instance, right? It says the Sabaoth in there. That's the word that is often translated hosts, which of course is just an old-fashioned word for armies. So if you go down in the concordance of Strong's, whatever else you have, and look at all the different ways it's translated and look at all the other references, it is not like they flocked or they served. It is uniformly a military word. So it's used in Numbers when it's talking about the people gathered together and made battle against the Medians.
Right.
It's used when they're talking about going to war. If you look down, it's military, 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 and then referencing these women, service, military, right. Military, military.
Yeah, and if we look at even Strong's definition, right, to amass an army or servants, he'll put in there, assemble, fight, perform, muster, wait upon, war. The Brown Driver Briggs lexicon is going to say it means to wage war.
Right.
If we go to Jesenius, as a soldier to war against anyone. Right.
So that should, no matter what our biases are, whenever we see a word suddenly being changed away from its definition to something that makes more sense culturally to whoever is translating, our eyebrow should be raised.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, and this is the root word that we see used in this verse.
Right.
Of this. So it's not even a
later evolution.
A later evolution or nuanced to be utilized in a different way. One of the things I thought was interesting about this specific reference of it, one is that this verse is the first time we see this root used in the text.
In this way, sure. It shows up earlier when talking about God in a different spot, I believe.
In a modified way, right? Because it's his name.
Right.
Right. But as far as the word itself in its root form, this is the first time we see it.
Yes.
Which I think is interesting. But also in the text here, it's used twice. And I'm not going to say this correctly, but it's Hatzavot, Asher Savot.
Yes.
Right? So it's the word twice with Asher.
The warrior Asher. Women, the female warriors, that warriored would be another way to translate it, right? Who warred.
Yeah. So it's not even the fact that there's the word woman in here.
Right.
It's just the feminine form of this
word.
Term
right.
for going forth to battle.
Right. Which that part isn't under dispute, right? Everybody uses that particular, that it is women here. They just suddenly say, maybe that's the word for service,
right.
Which is
not.
It could
be to battle.
We have Sharet, we have Avad, right? We've got different words for service. That's not that one.
Right.
But I know there are some pretty funky midrash when it comes to these looking glasses or these mirrors that they have.
Yeah, there are.
Silly women in their vanity always having mirrors. That's the subtext.
It is. Yeah. So a couple of interesting things that I found in the writings of the sages. One, we have Tu Ha'aroch, who is a later writer. He's going to translate this as using the mirrors of the legions. He's not even going to go with whether it's masculine or feminine. He's just going to say the mirrors of the legions.
A different kind of gloss over maybe something uncomfortable. Fascinating.
What they all seem to be talking about is there's a midrash that the Hebrew women in Egypt would have these looking mirrors that are used for what you would expect, right? Therefore, making yourself pretty in the morning, right? You hold the mirror, you do your hair, you tie it up certain ways. They need a way to look at themselves in order to do all
of
that.
Something
but then
you're
they would,
super familiar with,
yeah,
George.
Exactly. Yep, I do this every morning with my long, luscious locks. But then they would go out into the field where the laborers were to bring them water and food during the day.
Yes.
And they would deliver this water, but then it says that they would stand out in the field with these mirrors and kind of looking at themselves, remarking about how nice they looked in order to
draw attention.
Seduce the men.
Which is such a wild seduction technique, by the way. Just like, don't mind me over here doing an eyeliner check, I guess. You know, you can't
Right.
Oh my gosh.
But it's because of this that the Israelites were such a host coming out of Egypt, and they accredit it to them.
Right. So the origin of that midrash is solving the problem of we don't have very many generations for a enormous amount of Israelites to be born out of the line of Jacob. And so that's what that is trying to solve. But it's pretty classic because it layers in like something that those commentators might not like, or their predisposed ideas about women, that they're attached to mirrors. And then on top of that loads the extra like concern, like this is really what's wrong with that, is that women are using this power in order to overcome the minds of men who are just trying to do their work in the fields. And so I'm familiar with that midrash, and it ends then with talking about this as being a nice little redemption for those women, of they're giving up their vanity, they're giving up caring about what their eyeliner looks like or whatever, because they're willing to give over their mirrors to the service of the temple, which then this basin, I believe the midrash says, construes, is used to check in the Levitical law about whether women have committed adultery or not. So it's a nice little happy bow on it, like those wild, wanton women are able to repent, and then their mirrors are given over to the outing of other wild, wanton women who are full of danger.
Yeah, yeah. So that's in there, right? Which is interesting.
It's something.
Another thing that's interesting about this basin that the rabbis note on is it doesn't tell us how big the basin is. And there's conversation about the fact that the basin is literally as big as the amount of women who brought their mirrors for this basin to be fashioned out of. The idea being that they just took these mirrors and formed them into the basin without altering the mirrored surface itself.
Okay.
And so you end up with this massive mirrored bowl that gets filled with water. And dictated solely on the number of women who came. So they don't know how big this was.
Yeah.
But just imagining that you have these mirrors turned into this basin would be interesting.
Soldering it together. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could just imagine the guy off to the side whose job it is to carry
watching
this
all of these mirrors get piled up.
Like, no, not more, not more. Go back. No.
Yeah.
So all of this has to be carted everywhere they go, which is incredible.
Yeah. So just imagining that is, I would not want to be that laborer. The other interesting thing that I saw here was that an explanation for why they used these mirrors, which I find interesting. So it says, still another explanation, and this is recorded again by Tu Ha'aroch. He says, another explanation understands that the basin was constructed from these mirrors, as those priests who offered sacrifices on behalf of women had to be conscious of doing so on their behalf. By looking at the material this basin was made of, they would be stimulated to keep their donors, the women, in mind.
Oh boy.
It was forbidden for the priests to look directly at the faces of the women on whose behalf they offered their sacrifices, both mandatory ones and voluntary ones. So the woman would stand fairly close to the basin, and her image would be reflected in the mirror-like polish of the copper basin. And this would enable the priest to obtain a visual image of the woman on whose behalf he was performing his task, so that he could do so with the proper concentration on the donor personally, without actually looking at their face.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's kind of a Medusa vibe.
Another banger from Tur Ha'aroch. That guy, Yaakov Ben Asher, is from the medieval era, and he's bringing in his own ideas. That's certainly reflected in modern Orthodox Judaism, where men are not supposed to look at women, which is fascinating when you're in a city, you know, getting on the public transportation together. But
yeah.
Well, delightful. I want to zoom in on if it is warrior woman, as the actual text attests to.
Right.
And mirrors aren't just for vapid seduction and then the trials of other women and then enabling us to have a Medusa protection situation.
Yeah.
What would they be for? What is the military purpose of having a mirror?
Right. And we're all familiar with the fabled legend of using mirrors to burn the ships. in the manner of warfare. So in my personal opinion, these are to create space lasers.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yep, to fight off their enemies.
I mean, fascinating. Yeah, or lighting an underground crypt, right, as we see in any like archaeology movie. You turn a lever and it
you
moves
all got the
mirrors,
polished mirrors. They're covered with dust. You brush them off to send the light throughout throughout the crypt, light things up, of course,
right before the exactly bad giant scarab comes and eats you or whatever.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So the actual very handy use of something shiny in the military in the Bronze Age would be communication, because you don't want to scream across the hills, right? That's not very effective, and also tells everyone where you are. You don't necessarily want to like light a fire or whatever.
Sure.
Big
and a
smoke
mirror
trail
would be very direct,
but you can just shine a little mirror, do a little two flashes means X, three means Y, etc.
Right.
And boom, you can communicate across battalions or whatever. So
yeah, across an incredibly long distance, right?
Yeah, it's super helpful.
Yeah,
so that would be my
harnessing the power of the sun
proposal for what they're up to. But Who knows?
Maybe they're not mirrors. Maybe these are giant shields that have been polished into a mirror.
Okay. All right. Well, what a journey that was. What else do we have in this chapter 38, other than the stuff that we've read so many times?
So we have 9 through 20 is the court of the tabernacle. It's pretty straightforward. Lots of curtains, some silver hooks. The pins for the abiding place, all stuff that we have looked over before.
Right.
I want to get to this next section after that, the materials, the things for the attending of the abiding place, which is verses 21 through 31. And I want to talk about a few things in there because I did see some things that I thought were interesting.
Okay.
First off is there's commentary on the things specifically and the importance of these things in that, this is Forno here, one did not refer to it, these tools, only by the name of the category of the utensil it belonged to, such as fork, but one had a name for each fork or object.
Excellent.
And this method of naming each item individually contributed to their being of permanent significance. The Talmud, Yuma 71, goes to the length of stating categorically that if anyone thought that once such a utensil had been used up, had outlived its usefulness, it would be permanently consigned to oblivion, they are wrong. For in fact, it will even resurface after the resurrection of the people who used it when they were alive.
Wow, so, respawn.
Yeah, exactly. So taking their first reference from Exodus 26:15, there's something in the Hebrew there
that makes them think
that makes them think that it's going to endure indefinitely.
Wow.
So
I like that for three reasons. One, the individual naming of each thing is pretty cute. Reminds me of our three-year-old. He was naming every single rock that he was throwing into the bushes, being like, this one's named blah, 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 mommy. Like, cool. Cool, bud. I love that. Second off, we haven't had, like, magical objects or special objects in quite a while, right? We had the jorts of Adam a long time ago.
Yeah.
We had some other cool, I'm remembering some kind of vest, perhaps, that helped folks hunt better. Fascinating. So having a continually respawning, reappearing set of instruments is handy. I could use that for my keys. If I'm looking for something, have it just respawn by my hand. That would be awesome.
It's just kind of, you know, Harry Potter magic style, summoning the object back.
I suppose. How could that be when Harry Potter is actually of the devil? Asking the real questions, serious journalism. I also like, by the way, the service of the Levi'im. I re-input the meanings of that word and the one next to it because it's been a while. But Levite means entwined one. And before, I had only ever imagined that as like entwined with the work of God, because other great houses, other tribes get to, here's your land.
Yeah.
Here's your mission. Here's the flavor of the way you walk out the call of Abraham, right? Here's the occupation that you're up to. This is the character, the integrity, the feeling of our family. And the Levites don't get to do that. They don't have any land. They don't have their own identity other than being entwined with the service of the temple and the work of God. However, once we go through all of these fabrics, which my mother-in-law just taught me how to sew with a sewing machine and use a pattern to make little baby clothes, which was super, super fun, super challenging. And it took me, I know I'm a beginner and she was teaching me blah, 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 but it took me so long to make one thing. I cannot imagine how long it would take to make all of these curtains with all of their folds and all of their embroidery and all the fabric, which is like twisted upon the head.
Right.
Just so much cloak, blah, 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 blah. And all of that as is ingrained in my brain as violet and purple and scarlet thread and bleached white linen.
Yeah, repeated and repeated and repeated.
Over and over and over. So the Levi'im, right, they're entwined with the work of God, but also just literally walking around a giant spool of fabric.
Yeah. And if we jump down to chapter 39, we're going to see when they're talking about the garments, the that are made for the priests, right? We have this hammered out gold that's going to be woven into all of their fabric as well.
So, right, that's new. It says they stamped bird traps of the gold. They snipped wire to make it within the violet and the purple and the fibers of scarlet, etc. The word for snipped there is an onomatopoeia, which it is in English too. So that's fun. My question is if you're putting this gold wire in everybody's outfit, does it technically become light armor that helps keep them safe and not be punctured by a weapon?
Maybe from like a magical, mystical perspective, right? Because I think the idea being that the gold is so thin that it acts like a thread.
Okay.
Right. So it's malleable. I'm not familiar with threading gold, so I don't really know that much about it either. But I would imagine just because gold is such a soft metal that it wouldn't have a whole lot of use for that kind of thing. However, I still think that that's a cool idea. They say that the thread of gold, each spool, so to speak, each, you know, threading has six threads of color and one thread of gold kind of woven together.
Seven. Oh, that sounds like a Shabbat thing. Six threads and then seven.
And then
right?
one gold. Yeah, I like that.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's great. Yeah, I'll take that.
Excellent.
As an explanation.
Good work, everybody.
Six and then seven.
I like that more than the armor, actually, because
armor of God.
It's notable that, except for our brother Paul there, that there isn't military imagery, except for those warrior women, right? That it's not part of being a priest that you get like a giant spear or something.
Sure.
That's not part of the service of God. The Mandalorian is not part of actual theology. What is it? My weapon is my religion.
Yeah, something to that.
To that effect. In some corners of Christianity, that might feel more the case. However, in the early church, you had to repent of being in the army and quit the military in order to be able to even join Christian community. So the times, they have changed. So we're in 39 here. We have the sparkling ornament and all those stones again in their checkered array, which is fun. Still fun representing the tribes. And then we have the cloak, which I still love the design of, right? But one of my favorite lines in the cloak section is the mouth of the cloak in his midst as the mouth of a tachra. And we still don't know if that tachra is a dolphin or a manatee or a honey badger.
Right. Could be any of those.
But
yep.
I just love that image that the hole that your head goes through is like the mouth of that animal. So to me, that puts us more in a manatee or dolphin camp, because I don't know, maybe I could be wrong, but it feels like the mouth opening of a honey badger is smaller.
It is, but you know, I think of, like, you know, people make their wolf head, you know,
okay,
helmet type things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's possible to still be evoking that while having your head be able to fit through. I don't know. I thought it was interesting in chapter 39, verse 21, that they bound the sparkling ornament from the rings to the rings of the apron in a violet cord to be above the woven waistband of the apron. The reason I say that is because to me, saying that they bound it, it was evocative of the Abraham and Isaac story, where Abraham binds Isaac as part of that.
Okay.
And just the comparison between the priests are here, right, as part of offering sacrifices. And we see similar symbology with the ram's horn and the horns that are used and a couple of other things. So I thought that was interesting because the sparkling ornament represents the tribes of Israel, and they are bound to the priest in this way, kind of similar to, you know, we talked about the shoulder pads as well, as having that, the names carved into them, which would also be, you know, very cool from a visual perspective. But I liked that comparison.
Yeah.
There was also, you know, I can't remember if we talked about this when it came up the first time, but there's also this commentary about the, they made upon the skirt of the cloak pomegranates of violet and purple and woven scarlet, and they made bells of clean gold.
Mm-hmm.
They gifted the bells in the midst of the pomegranates upon the skirt of the cloak. And so this is verses 24 and 25 of 39. And so there's this kind of debate about the placement of these pomegranates and bells. The Rambam is going to say that because of the way this is phrased, that the bells were placed within the pomegranates while they were still detached, and they put the pomegranates on the skirts of the robe about while the bells were within them. And so they would hollow out the pomegranates,
okay,
and put bells inside. And then we have this 18th century Moroccan
fellow
rabbi, yeah, Ur HaChaim,
uh-huh,
is going to say, yeah, that's ridiculous. They just put them side by side.
Okay.
So there's some argument going on about the arrangement of these pomegranates and bells.
Ur HaChaim, by the way, means light of the life, which is a great name. Power to our Moroccan fellow here. Yeah, I mean, it says a bell and a pomegranate and a bell and a pomegranate. It feels like it would have been easy to say a bell in with the prefix ba if they wanted to, and they didn't.
Right.
So,
they used in the midst of.
That would be betoch. That would be a different word.
Right. That is what is in here. So differentiating between inside of versus in the midst of.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see what you're talking about. Fascinating. The thing that I love about this section that I missed the last time we did it is that the word for bell comes from the root moment. And so a moment is the ringing of a bell, or the ringing bell brings you to the moment.
Very Buddhist.
Yeah. Or at least not American Protestant.
Right.
We don't have bells. Those are Catholic. For whatever reason. Okay. So we've got the rolled turban again, with so much white linen, hills of white linen. I love, by the way, that the KJV, instead of calling them turbans, calls them goodly bonnets. That would be fantastic.
That's great.
If we made all of the church authorities.
My bonnet.
Yeah. Wear goodly bonnets.
Where is my goodly bonnet?
10 out of 10. Why did we get those like tall Catholic hats when we could have just had like prairie bonnets?
That'd be great.
It would be so good. Alas, KJV has not won out there. We're also missing our nice little flower that we had last time. So I don't know why that's not here. But we do have the inscription set apart for Yahweh on it, which if you're going to have an inscription on you, that's a pretty good one. And then we've got violet wire, which is also new. So that's fun. And then we have this last longest list of all time, just listing out everything that we've been talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Right, because they bring the abiding place to Moshe, and they're like, you know what would be great if when we bring the abiding place, we again list everything out again.
Right. It feels very Sondheim, the composer, or again, like a Beauty of the Beast. I can just imagine this being sung. Like, I can imagine Lin-Manuel Miranda doing it. You know, the reaching beams and his pillars and his pedestals and covering of red and ramskins or whatever.
Right.
It goes on and on and on and on. And then at the end of all that, totally relatable. In my mind, it's almost like Moshe falls to his knees. And I was like, oh my gosh, we finally did it. And then he blesses them, right?
Yeah.
Which I love. It also says, I believe there's a midrash that you've mentioned outside of the pod where they did it according to as Yahweh commanded, not as Moshe commanded.
Right. And yeah.
Kind of brings back our Bezalel hiding in the bushes on the mountain thing.
Yeah, so we see that in chapter 38, verse 22. It says, and Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, for the staff of Yehuda, made all that Yahweh commanded Moshe. And Rashi puts this note in here, and it says, it is not stated here Bezalel made all that had been commanded, but rather all that the Lord had commanded Moses, even regarding such things which his teacher Moses did not tell him. His own opinion was in agreement with what had been told to Moses on Sinai. For Moses bade Bezalel to make the vessels first and the tabernacle afterwards. But Bezalel said to him, surely it is the way of the world first to build a house and then to place the household utensils in it. He replied to him, so indeed did I hear from the mouth of the Holy One, blessed be he. And Moses further said to him, you must have been sitting in the shadow of God, for certainly did thus God command me.
Excellent.
And so he made the things.
Excellent. May we all have a Bezalel in our corner who can back us up and be like, is that what God said? Let's reorient.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. And then to bring in verse 33, where it says they brought the abiding place to Moshe, the note that Rashi has, which we mentioned of kind of the mystical, magical erection of the temple.
Right.
I love the wording that he has here. So the Holy One, blessed be he, left for him the task of erecting it, for nobody was able to set it up because of the weight of the boards, which no human strength was capable of setting up. Moses, however, succeeded in placing it in position. Moses said to the Holy One, blessed be he, how is its erection possible by human beings? And God answered him, you be busy with your hand. So just pretend like you're being busy. And he appeared to be erecting it, but in fact, it set itself up and rose of its own accord. And that is exactly what Scripture says in Exodus 40:17. The tabernacle was erected, and doesn't say who did it.
Incredible. So, I see. Yeah, it's active without some other agent accomplishing it.
Right.
I love that. That's so this super
is,
fun.
Yeah, so this is a midrash of Rabbi Tanchuma, so Okay. Check it out.
All right. Well, we are almost there. We're almost at the end. One last chapter left. So join us next week. I think that's your line.
It is my line. This has been the Text and Us podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope that you will join us again next week for Exodus chapter 40 as we finish off this book.